The International Olympic Committee has the honor to announce that the Games of the 35th Olympiad are awarded to Brisbane, Australia.
When the IOC awarded the 2032 Summer Games to Brisbane last month, the future of the Olympics was determined for more than a decade to come. But thanks to scandal after scandal after scandal after scandal, and now a Tokyo Games that many simply tuned out, that future also looks as bleak as it ever has. Today, our Olympics savant, Jeremy Schapp, explains why the Olympic flame might be burning out. And then Katie Nolan illuminates the sport where she once took gold. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, August 6th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. Jeremy Schapp, how many Olympics have you covered? What's the number at?
Eight. Five Winter Games, three Summer Games. I was on pace, though, for many more a long time ago. I was at three in a row from 92 to 94, three in 2 years. And the pace has kind of slackened.
I imagine it's a lot to keep bouncing around various cities on this planet trying to maintain an encyclopedic knowledge of every sport that's ever been played.
That's why I pretty much stopped in 1996. I don't accumulate any knowledge starting with 1996. It's kind of my end point. And I figure, you know, we've got so many colleagues who know everything that's actually going on in the last quarter century. Nobody needs me for that. I could be the centuries before that guy.
That is why I am here to talk to you, because you're not in Tokyo this year. No, nope. That is true. But you are a historian of this entire enterprise. You're kind of this human Wikipedia of Olympic knowledge.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
Well, I'm going to test it here, because as this thing reaches its conclusion, Jeremy, there is a term that I discovered recently that sounds like both a medical condition and a philosophy, and that term is Olympism. And I want to read for you from the IOC, the International Olympic Committee's website, because they say that, quote, "The goal of Olympism is to place sport at the service of the harmonious development of humankind, with the view to promoting a peaceful society concerned with the preservation of human dignity," end quote. That is Olympism. Do you think the Olympics are succeeding towards that end right now?
You know, you're reading from the Olympic Charter, Pablo, and it's always had this, this goal of bringing the world together through the efforts of Olympic athletes every 4 years. The rhetoric, as lofty as it is, hasn't been lived up to. I don't want to denigrate everything about the Olympics, right? I think the competition is great. I think there is something about the games that is universal and has the power to bring us together in a moment. But if the goal was to create this kind of universal understanding, when the games were revived in 1896, right, by Baron de Coubertin with those first games in Athens, well, look at the history of the world since then. Look at the horrors of the 20th century. When the games took place, let's say, in Hitler's Berlin in 1936, when blind eyes have been turned to all kinds of bad things at places at which the Olympics were taking place. You can't blame the Olympics for that, but it's hard to draw a line from what the Olympics were trying to achieve. And trust me, the Olympics set for themselves a very high standard and very high bar in global society. They don't think of themselves as just some sports event. They think of themselves, as you say, as a movement.
Preservation of human dignity is a lofty goal.
Exactly. And sometimes I wonder, you know, when the big shots of the Olympics, the members of the IOC get together, you know, whether they laugh at that stuff, because there's so many examples in history of not living up to those ideals.
So, Jeremy, if that ideal is not the practical, real-world mission at this point, what is it?
Well, I think, like so many things, right, it's self-perpetuation. the people who run the Olympics, the cities that still choose to want to host them, that's an increasingly small cohort, they might think at one level, you know, the games are important and that they can send a message and they can be a change agent. They might think that, but I think, you know, anything that gets this big and this powerful creates its own culture of self-perpetuation.
Yes.
And that's what we see. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the question is, to what end? The question now for many cities, global cities, right, is why do we need this? Look at all the problems. Look at all, look at what they're going to expect from us. Why are we going to spend all this money? It's unlikely that these games will in any way benefit your bottom line. And cities and citizens have gotten wise to it. The prestige of the Olympics has diminished. And along with what we've seen in terms of the scandals, whether it's Salt Lake City and the outrageous gifts for IOC members, and it's that kind of cronyism that turns people off, which is another reason why we don't watch the games or love the games perhaps the way that we once did.
Well, I want to get to how I think broadly the Olympics has been consumed and perceived in the modern day, Jeremy, given all that backdrop, because it seems like right now, TV ratings, interest, they seem down significantly for the Tokyo Games. And to some degree, by the way, that's not a surprise.
No.
Beyond the machinations and the nuances of TV ratings in general, the fact is there's a time zone difference. There are no spectators allowed because of COVID. There's a Japanese public that does feel like these games were foisted upon them. They didn't want this thing to go forward, by and large, according to polls. Even beyond that, though, it does feel like there's something almost quaint about this entire thing, and it doesn't feel as big and as important as it used to. And I'm curious if you feel that and why that might be.
Well, I felt that for a long way. I mean, the Tokyo Games are something obviously very specific because of the global pandemic and the restrictions at the games themselves and the reluctance, and I think that's understating it, of the Japanese people to have these games. But you got to go back to the history of the games. And I know you know that I was going to go back to the history.
Jeremy, at any given moment, I'm not sure if we're going to go back 1,000 years or 100 years. So I'm excited to see where we go with this.
Well, think about it this way. I would say there are a lot of factors, of course, at play in explaining why the Olympics seem less relevant now than they have in the past. First of all, as you alluded to, everything is less relevant. Mm-hmm. Everything is less of a big tent.
Yes.
Except maybe the Super Bowl, right? Everything
Correct.
Else has gotten smaller.
The Super Bowl and superheroes are the only things that right. maintain the American attention.
Exactly. And so there is that. But there is also the fact that, you know, until 1952, the Olympics were kind of a different animal. They were in some ways, and they've been described this way by others, as kind of an overgrown world track and field championships. Track and field far and away dominated the games. 1952, the Soviet Union shows up for the first time in Helsinki. And then what we get over the course of the next 3+ decades is the golden age of the Olympics. Why? Because of the conflict between the United States and the Western democracies, its allies, against the Soviet Union and its satellite countries in the Eastern Bloc behind the Iron Curtain. You know, and this is kind of the ultimate irony, right? The point is to bring people together, global understanding, brotherhood of man, all of that
peace,
stuff.
Peace, yes.
Peace, you know. And yet the games really reach their apogee in terms of relevance because they become a kind of proxy competition for the Cold War. What is the defining Olympic moment for most Americans?
The Miracle on Ice, Jeremy. It has to be the Miracle on Ice.
Right. It's so big that it's considered, I think, in most of those surveys, like the greatest sports moment ever.
Yes.
All right? It's not about just a bunch of American college kids beating a bunch of crypto professionals. It's about the U.S. versus the Soviet Union.
Mm.
It's about the U.S. and our system versus their system. And so we don't have that anymore. So that's a major reason why the Olympics are less relevant to many people, although the games were never supposed to be about nations against nations. That's always been baloney too, right? So they say it's about the individuals, but we have a parade of nations and everybody competes under a flag. So there are these conflicting messages which have never really been resolved or reconciled.
It also seems telling to me, Jeremy, that like one of the main legacies, it feels like, of this particular Tokyo Games is the fact that Americans will probably think of Simone Biles and withdrawing from her most high-profile events, not competing in the team and the all-around competitions, and the fact that she's talked about mental health as the reason for her withdrawal. She made a point the other day of saying,
at the end of the day, we're not just entertainment, we're humans, and there are things going on behind the scenes that we're also trying to juggle with as well, on top of sports.
So do you think that Simone Biles and her decision and how she's talked about all of this openly now, do you think that represents something larger about how we look at Olympic athletes?
I think it speaks to the enormous pressures that Olympic athletes are under. The way that we perceive the games as being special because of the scarcity, every four years, I should say. You know, there's so much pressure. And I think about that when I watch gymnastics and I watch swimming and I watch in the winter games, you know, the skiing competition, because you only get that shot every 4 years. And the weight of that is tremendous. And there was that documentary recently about Olympians and mental health, the weight of gold. I spoke to Michael Phelps at length about it last year at the height of the pandemic, and he's been very outspoken about his battles with depression. I think it's a hard life. I think even though, you know, we look at Olympians now in a way that we don't generations ago, you know, in terms of the opportunities to make money and assume, well, that makes it all okay, right? You know, because now they can make money. I don't know Simone Biles' bank account, but I don't think it matters, right? I mean, I'm assuming that she's rich. But, you know, what she's been through the last few years, the way that our gymnasts were treated by USA Gymnastics in the midst of the Larry Nassar scandal, failing to protect our gymnasts. And I think another factor too, Pablo, and I haven't heard Simone Biles talk about this specifically. Maybe I missed it. Maybe she did. Maybe she didn't. I think for all athletes now, there's also the added pressure of social media. I think knowing that everybody is not only watching, but everybody is weighing in is hard.
Well, that gets me, Jeremy, to this contradiction, this tension, this paradox, because as we said at the very beginning of this, this is a games, this is an enterprise designed in theory to promote human dignity. The athletes increasingly feel like their humanity is in conflict with the way this entire pressure cooker has been operating both in the event and behind the scenes and in the run-up to it in the case of USA Gymnastics. But it feels like you do still have an appreciation for the athletic ambition and for the pressure on some level. I mean, look, this thing is about to end, and I know there are going to be Roman numerals and flames and all this stuff decorating it, but I get the feeling that for you, this thing matters in a way that's deeper than that. So I'm curious why, if you have any love for it, where does that love come from?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's about the sacrifice, the skills, and the pure physical joy of it. Seeing athletes perform when the stakes are so high, which again is what makes it so tough, right? And why so many athletes are struggling, I think, with these pressures. It's not that we enjoy seeing people in pain, but we enjoy seeing people rise to the occasion. And now I think we have an increasing understanding of why we have to be understanding when the pressure gets to be too much. There is something about what the Olympics, despite everything, try to represent, or what the athletes try to represent, if not the movement itself. I mean, I could give you example after example from Berlin to Munich of the ways the Olympic movement has failed aggressively. And yet, the athletes, they are what lifts up the whole enterprise. However much it gets dragged down by the corruption and the politics and the insincerity, the movement is still lifted up by the athletes.
All right, Jeremy, coming up, I want to dive even deeper into your rabbit hole of a brain, because I am sure that there are some Olympic sports in there that I've never even heard of.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
All right, Jeremy, now that we've gotten the serious stuff out of the way, the stuff with gravity out of the way, I wanted to get to what I actually brought you to talk about with me here today, because yes. I know everyone talks about swimming and gymnastics and the headline glamour events, but your favorite event,
right,
as I understand it, is just heating up. So what is it?
You know, it's another thing I inherited from my dad. He was preoccupied with the event that was originally known as the military pentathlon. And then after 1924, was rebranded as the modern pentathlon.
Mm.
It's a great event, Pablo. You know why it's a great event?
I do not.
I'm going to tell you. No other event, no other athletic competition seeks to represent the skills required of a Napoleonic military courier.
That really should be more prominently advertised under the subtitle of this event.
The decathlon's great. The heptathlon's great. But, you know, those skills are all kind of in the subset of track and field. Not so with modern pentathlon. Modern pentathlon, again, imagine you are a courier behind enemy lines and you have to get a message. Let's go forward from the Napoleonic Wars. Let's go to the Crimean War. And
sure.
You want the message to get there to, I guess it was Lord Raglan, right? Or was it Cardigan?
I'm going to nod along as if I have any idea what you're talking about.
You got to get them the message. Do not let the Light Brigade charge.
Oh, the Light Brigade. Who could forget?
Into the jaws of
Who
death.
Could forget, okay? The Light Brigade and the jaws of death.
So you have to know. You have to know how to ride, obviously.
A horse.
You have to know how to run a horse. Yes, what else would you have to ride?
I don't know what's happening in Napoleonic courier times, Jeremy. You're acting like that's the ridiculous detail in this conversation.
Okay. We've got riding, we've got running, we've got fencing, we've got swimming, because you're going to have to ford a river.
Right. Yeah, the Oregon Trail and the Napoleonic courier have that much in common, fording rivers.
And you have to shoot. You have to know how to shoot. So five separate distinct skills, which the average human being, you know, never needs to use. But we're not talking about average human beings. We're talking about modern pentathletes.
So what about this allegedly modern pentathlon, Jeremy, speaks to you still today as we sit here and you marvel at all of these things?
It speaks to me because I'm a little bit of a history buff and the archaic skills that are required here, the fencing and the riding and all that, because of course, you know, you don't really have to ride anymore, to get messages from behind enemy lines. Anyway, I like it. It's just, you know why I like it, Pablo, to be truthful? Because nobody else does. That's why.
So Jeremy, when you survey the history of the all-time greats, the GOAT pentathletes, who comes to your mind's eye?
One of them was a West Point graduate competing at the 1912 games in Stockholm. He would have been 26 or 27 years old, a Southern Californian, and he considered shooting his finest event of the five disciplines in the modern pentathlon, but he did everything else exceptionally in the competition. There were 42 competitors in 1912 in modern pentathlon. He ended up finishing fifth, but he only finished that low out of the medals because he didn't shoot very well. He finished 20th in the shooting competition. And that man would later become the commander of two corps in North Africa, the 7th Army in Sicily, the 3rd Army in Northwest Europe, one General George S. Patton, Jr.
So wait, hold on. So just for the listener's knowledge here, Jeremy Shapp said all of that without consulting any notes, just wildly gesturing, seized by the spirit of old blood and guts himself, it felt like, Jeremy. That George Patton was a modern pentathlete.
That George Patton was a modern pentathlon.
My God.
Pentathlete, I should say. He was not the competition.
So hold on. Okay. I think I understand the modern pentathlon and you more than I ever have. But I do want to ask you about these other, like, actually modern new sports that are also being introduced here, because we have skateboarding, we have surfing, and we have breakdancing in 2024. So how do you feel about the new class of Olympic events?
I have mixed feelings, honestly, Pablo. You know, I understand they want to appeal to younger people. I'm not about appealing to younger people. That's never been my thing.
Yeah, had not noticed that either.
So I don't know. I mean, like, you know, kind of co-opting the X Games, seeing the success of the X Games, and then saying, we want some of this. And I'll be honest, you know, I think it works. It has worked in the Winter Games, clearly.
Well, Jeremy, it does feel like you feel the way I feel, which is kind of like the Olympics are showing up and they have suddenly a hat turned around backwards and they're saying, how do you do, my fellow kids? Like, there's a little too much of the false try-harding of all of this.
And at a certain point, you have to worry, like, does it dilute it? Like, were the Olympics meant to be everything? I don't know. I mean, there have been a lot of weird sports, discontinued events. I mean, kind of the ultimate weird thing is tug of war, right?
I can't believe that was an actual sport in the Olympics.
Well, it was. And so they had tug of war. They had other kinds of things that felt more like they were from a county fair or something like that, or, you know, school, what is that, field day kind of thing. They also had stuff like city planning, and architecture competitions, and art stuff.
That's
and it was because
incredible.
The Olympics were part of these other festivals as well, kind of these world fairs that took place, like the Exposition in Paris in 1900 and St. Louis in 1904. So it was kind of confusing where the world's fairs ended and the Olympics began.
Mm.
But I think there are gold medals out there for art and architecture. They had a lot of that, but the king of the discontinued sports, kind of the figure who towers above them all, was Ray Urey.
I have no idea who that
is. You should. You should. And we all should. Because Ray Urey is one of the great Olympians ever, and he's entirely forgotten through no fault of his own, but only because the events that he dominated in a way that perhaps no one has ever dominated any sport are all gone. They've all been discontinued. Ray Urey was the king. Of the standing jumps. And again, I keep coming back to my dad and the things he wrote, but he spent a lot of time thinking about writing about Ray Urey, who won 10 gold medals, 10 individual gold medals in the standing broad jump, standing triple jump, and standing high jump. Okay. And they are exactly what they sound like. You don't get to run up to the bar or to the pit. You have to just do it from a stop.
So Ray Urey, to be clear, would kill a combine.
Unbelievable.
Drill. That's what you're describing.
Urey won all 10, I believe, standing jump events that ever took place at the games.
Yeah, I was going to ask, when was this happening? What years are we talking about here?
Yeah, he's 1900 to 1908. So it depends how you define it, right? It's either, well, there's 1900 Paris, 1904 St. Louis, 1906. 06 intercalated games and 1908 London. Some people say 1906 shouldn't count because they were interstitial games between the major games of the Olympiad every time around, but they only did it once in 1906, and Urey won either two or three gold medals in 1906. And so some people think those shouldn't count, but I count them.
It occurs to me, Jeremy, that, like, if arts and city planning used to be events, podcasting, we should be on that Olympic movement. Podcasting as an Olympic sport.
You should be. You have one. They'd have to rescind the qualifying standards to get me into the competition. But you would be a high seed. And I don't want to kiss your butt, but you'd be a high seed.
Jeremy Shapp, I have no doubt that we can figure out some corrupt scheme to get you onto the podcasting medal stand.
let us hope.
Thank you, Jeremy, as always, for taking us back in time.
Thank you for indulging me.
Coming up, another ESPN GOAT shares her very personal experience with Olympic gymnastics, but not the kind you think.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. So the Olympics are about to end, and while all of us are very familiar by now with the sort of gymnastics that Simone Biles does, there is another form of gymnastics that begins today in Tokyo. And so I needed to talk to ESPN Daily's senior rhythmic gymnastics correspondent, Katie Nolan, to find out more. So look, Katie, we are talking because all-around rhythmic gymnastics begins on Friday in Tokyo, and people need to know that you won the gold medal in rhythmic gymnastics, the gold medal, at the Junior Olympics in 1997. Is that right?
Yes, it was in group. I've never really said that out loud because it never really felt relevant. But now that I'm hearing you talk, it's less impressive. I was part of a group, and together we all won gold.
There's nothing wrong with winning as a team. But
thank you.
But I need to ask you how vivid your memory is of that experience. Like in your brain, for those who were not lucky enough to attend the 1997 Junior Olympics.
In Atlanta, Georgia.
In Atlanta, Georgia, what did that look like?
You know what, Pablo? My memory of it is a little spotty. I remember that in 96 was when they first started doing group rhythmic gymnastics in the Olympics. And so that was a big year. Mm. And then the next year, we had our Junior Olympics in the same city. It was in Atlanta. And so I remember it being exciting. I remember it being a big deal. I remember Sugar Ray being a very popular band at the time. I believe
yes.
I Just Want to Fly had just come out. So that was kind of like our team anthem. As for the rest of it, look, rhythmic gymnastics competitions in my youth were never popping. It was never very popular, but it was my weird little thing that I loved so much. And I'm very excited to watch this year.
What did you look like at your peak as a rhythmic gymnast?
So, well, at my peak, I think I'd started to grow my hair out. But when I was starting out, I had what could be described as like a Jaromir Jagr haircut. I had a very short, and like people, I've told tales of this haircut, and people are always like, yeah, I'm sure it was fun. And then when I show them the picture, they're like, whoa, you weren't kidding. Like it was very short and very fluffy.
Mullet is not fair to what you're describing here. It's a lot more feathered and...
Yes, it's got a lot of volume up top.
Yes.
Yeah, there is business in the front, but it's kind of a business party. It's kind of like a work party in the front and then straight party in the back.
Yeah, like an after work drink situation in the back.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Could verge on sloppiness, but for the time being is absolutely on point.
Exactly.
I want to understand, and I want people to understand, like, what is the difference between rhythmic gymnastics and gymnastics that we should all be understanding here? Because they are not the same thing.
They're not actually even that similar. There's a lot of differences. The difference between gymnastics and rhythmic gymnastics, I would say rhythmic gymnastics is more dance-based. It's more about movement to the music. Routines are all set to music, and it needs to be incorporated into your routine. We don't do flip. I say we, like I'm still going. I'm still an active ambassador.
No, use the royal we. It is deserved.
You don't flip. There aren't stunts in that way. Most of the difficulty and stunts come from either flexibility or risk taken with the apparatus, the various apparatus that you can use. There's five different apparati.
Yeah, what are we need to know?
Could
the
you
apparati.
Try to name the ones you know?
I know that there's a ribbon.
Yep.
End of list.
That's it?
I mean, there's like a ball,
yep.
Right?
Ribbon ball.
Okay. No, wait. There's, I know it's not, I mean, I apologize.
It's not a hula hoop.
It's not a hula hoop. Exactly. Yeah. But
just
there's
a
hoop-esque
yep.
Hoop.
You've got two left.
Oh my gosh. And I feel like there's got to be like one of those things you throw. Or is that also...
You throw all of them. Rope
okay.
Is one of the ones you're missing.
Rope. I would never have guessed rope.
Rope has been in and out of competition. They've taken it out. They've put it back in. And then clubs. My least favorite of the apparati, right? Is plural of apparatus?
Apparatuses is what our producers
oh,
are
Oh, really? Apparatuses.
Is
I've been
plural.
Saying apparati the whole time. Fix it in
I think we should... I think we should actually just insist on calling it apparati. That sounds far more sophisticated.
Whatever. Clubs is the word. It's two clubs. They're like these little sticks, basically. Almost like devil sticks, but with a little like bell at the end. And devil sticks is a dated
love a
reference.
Devil stick.
Kids have no idea what I'm talking about. When you were learning to use clubs growing up, Pablo, they were made of hard plastic. Now they're made of rubber and they're a lot easier to throw, but you would have to throw these gigantic things in the air and they're very heavy and scary.
So the ribbon catching and the club throwing and the hooping, like,
yep.
Did you ever hurt yourself doing
all the time.
Any of this?
All the time. I had a lot of ankle injuries. Which I imagine is common for all types of gymnastics, but it's a lot of leaping and bending and you know, dancing and being cool.
Yes.
Most injuries to my ego, I would say, because the rules that people don't realize for a lot of the different apparatuses are like ribbon, for example. That ribbon is not allowed to stop moving for the entire routine. It has to constantly be in motion. So I would always, this is such a triggering phrase for me. I would always get in trouble for dead ribbon, which would basically just be like dead air for a broadcaster where like you just sat there and you didn't do anything with it. So it was constant movement of your wrists with ball, that tiny little, so it's like a rubbery, it's kind of like a thick rubber ball that's smaller than a basketball.
I love how there's no article in front of ball.
It's not ball.
Nope. The ball.
It's just ball.
Because a true rhythmic gymnastics head knows that it is just ball.
It's ball.
Ball is life, yes.
Ball is life. I hated ball. Ugh. But you're not allowed to grip it. You have to let it rest in your hand. So when you're watching, if they use ball, I think actually this year the group competition is five balls. One of them is five balls and the other is three hoops and four clubs. But it's when they put the ball all around their body, they're not allowed to hold on to it. It has to be like resting on their hand. So it's it makes it much more impressive and fascinating that they cannot grip that ball. One of the endpoints for somebody who was a rhythmic gymnast as a young person was Cirque du Soleil. That was like off season, or like a goal would be that you could someday compete or perform in Cirque du Soleil.
Wow, wait, so is that something that you personally had contemplated? Katie Nolan, Cirque du Soleil superstar.
Yeah, and then also pretty soon after contemplating, realized I just wasn't good enough. It's what it all comes down to. It's the thing we're avoiding
talking
about. You
won a gold medal,
Katie.
What are you talking about? Hold on.
I won a gold medal amongst very few. The field was slim. There weren't that many other teams competing. It was impressive at the time for a 10-year-old girl, an incredible achievement. But it really peaked around then, and I probably stopped by the time I was 15 or 16. So it wasn't like I wasn't phenomenal. My mom will say otherwise. If my mom listens to this, she'll tell me I could have been pro, I could have done it, but it just wasn't, it was a lot. It's tough.
I mean, so if you were to try and go out there now, and like try to just get in game shape, what would that feel like?
Pain is the first thought that comes to mind in various muscle groups that I have not interacted with in many years, maybe over multiple decades at this point. But, you know, I've thought about it. The thing about rhythmic gymnastics, it's just kind of a blessing, is that if you don't have the space to do it, you really can't just go do it. So it's not like I can find out, which is probably for the best. But I do think one day I would like to, you know, interact with one of those hoops covered in sparkly tape. Man, taping your hoop used to take so long. But I would love to interact with just a, yeah, you'd have to wrap around and it would match your leotard, which again, to give you a little taste of the times I was coming up in, crushed velvet was very big for us. That was our big fashion statement on our leotards, was crushed velvet. But I think I would love to try it again just to see if now I have the mental discipline, because back then a lot of it was just not conscious of too many things at once. A lot of deductions for unpointed toes. And I think if I tried it again, I would stink, but I think I could at least find out how bad.
So when you watch this stuff, Katie, when you will watch this stuff in the Olympics, what are you going to watch for? What should we be watching for?
Well, the biggest thing, if you're listening to this from the United States, this is a big year for us. This is the first time we've ever fielded an entire rhythmic gymnastics full team. So we have two individual athletes going, and then we have a team competing, which is big. Laura Zhang is our big star. She came in 11th in Rio, and she, coming to Tokyo, will only be the second U.S. rhythmic Olympic gymnast who's gone twice to the Olympics. So it's her second time in the Olympics. She's great. I won't say she's a favorite. This is dominated by Eastern European countries. Like Bulgaria had a run in the 80s, 90s. That's when I was growing up. We were all talking about Bulgaria.
Which kid in the 90s wasn't constantly just talking about Bulgaria?
Just very focused on Bulgaria and what was going on there. But I think what I'll be watching for, honestly, Pablo, it is the most... I genuinely don't think you need to know a lot about it to enjoy it. The point of the sport is its artistry, is how beautiful it is to watch. So you can go into it knowing nothing and just know if something is aesthetically pleasing. It's very entertaining. And you might not understand the numbers, the scoring, they actually change after every Olympics. So it's constantly evolving. It's very difficult to keep track of. But all you really need to be looking for is, in group competition, are they together? Are they on beat? Are there exchanges between apparatuses? Are they clean? Are they happening at the same time? Their catch point, their release point. It's just there to entertain and to be beautiful, to be observed. And I find it to be so fascinating, and it's so skilled and intricate and detailed that I feel like anybody could watch and enjoy rhythmic gymnastics, much like synchronized swimming. You can tell that's impressive, it's beautiful. I don't quite understand, but boy, do I enjoy it.
Katie Nolan, thank you for keeping this ribbon very much alive.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to pay off this strange hobby I dedicated so much of my childhood to. My mom is going to be so proud of me.
Ball is life. Ball really is Ball's still life. Life.
Ball is life.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Andres Soto, Christian Gardner, Jim Briggs, Garrett Lang, Max Brodsky, and Jackson Ugelo. I'll talk to you Monday.